You got any tinsel on you, man?
You know that I do.
Be a whole lot cooler if it was on the tree.
Well, but if it was on the tree, what were we going to smoke?
That's a good question, actually. This is Holidays and Confused.
Nice.
Yeah. So, welcome everybody to, what is this, the third? Yes, the third installment of All I Want for Geekmas, which is, of course, our holiday geeky gift guide.
Unless you count the written blog that was put together by our interns.
Yes, which was awesome.
Yes, which was also awesome.
I like that one a lot. You guys should check that out. It's essentially what one real thing and one entirely unobtainable thing from the geek world that they would like for Christmas this year. That was a lot of fun, actually. But this is the third installment of one of the ones we're basing sort of off of the Blu-rays and DVDs that have come out over the last year in our recording efforts, our epic journey across the land of home releases. We have landed here.
A year's worth of shit worth watching.
Why didn't we just call it that? A year's worth of shit worth watching.
Because it didn't have that distinctive Christmassy feel.
I guess you're right. Well, I'm Brian.
I'm Chris.
And thank you for joining us here on One of Usnet. I want to remind you that all the content that we're spewing out here is available on iTunes. Just search One of Us in the podcast section. And please, please, please do consider using our Amazon links here that we're going to put up for all these different releases. Even if you don't buy the specific release that we put up, just getting to Amazon via our link and then buying anything supports the site, and we appreciate it.
You're damn right it does, Brian.
I am damn right. And it damn does, damn it.
And I would add something to that if you hadn't already summed it up so well. I feel awkward at this point. Like the newsman who it's just been switched over to, but who's like,
My teleprompter's broken.
My girlfriend just broke up with me.
Why did they put that in the teleprompter? That's just irresponsible. But today we're going to be covering, oh my gosh, we're going to be covering comedy. We're going to be covering drama. We're going to be covering sci-fi, horror, and crazy.
It's like the Greek masks, except with one extra one that is like an alien shape.
Yes. Yeah. Like a xenomorph mask is the third one.
Martial arts and Asian films. This is actually it's going to have the most amount of titles of any of these we've done so far.
Yeah, that'll be fun to put up and post. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
I love the experience of messing with WordPress.
Oh, fuck WordPress. Like, especially today, just fuck it so hard. Anywho, Christmas, I should not be such a Grinch. So let's get started with, I don't know, which category do you want to start with? Comedy?
Might as well just start with comedy.
Let's do it. What is the first item on your list of... Now, keep in mind, guys... These aren't necessarily movies that came out in theaters in 2013, but these are things that were released on Blu-ray and or DVD in 2013.
And they're also, some of them are just because, goddammit, this was just such a great release to come out this year and you should see it, and some of them because of a combination of that and the extra features that they're bundled with.
True story.
Just the whole package. It depends. I like to say, with girls, it's all about my whole package. So
yeah.
It never works.
I thought you were going to tell girls about all your depends.
It's so. Not about Christmas as so much as Moss Chris.
Oh,
you know what,
Lord.
I'm saying?
It's a good pun, but I don't want to acknowledge it.
Or a massive Chris, depending on how you look at it. Anyway, the first title on my list is Monty Python's The Meaning of Life on Blu-ray, the 30th anniversary edition. This is one of the funniest comedies ever made. It was certainly one of the funniest, like, sort of sketch comedy things ever made. The Monty Python guys were the last of their series of films that they released, and certainly the rudest and crudest out of it, all of them. Really create some magic with this one, and it is the one out of all of them that is definitely not for children. Now, what, of course, sets us apart from previous releases is that they do a 30th anniversary reunion that's about just over an hour long, where they sit down with all the surviving Pythons, including Terry Gilliam, and they just shoot the shit for an hour, quite frankly. It's
nice.
Loosely organized, but you can tell somebody had been feeding these people scotch. Because they're just, like, obviously still get along great, and they're just laughing and having a terrific time. It's one of those... You probably are going to watch more than once, actually, just because you kind of didn't catch everything, because it's like a Blue Christmas episode.
Which is up on the site, too, by the way.
But you can also, all the 2003 DVD release extras on here, which are sizable, including whole sequences that were never originally included in this movie. It's just a fantastic package. Commentary with Terry Gilliam and Terry Jones. You know, I mean, there's so much good stuff here. This is... essential owning piece here, really is. I love The Meaning of Life. I love all the Monty Python movies, but this Blu-ray edition really treats it special.
Well, since you went classic and British with your first pick, I'm going to do the same thing and talk about The Beatles' Help.
Oh, are they from Britain?
Yes, they are, in fact.
Okay.
Some pool full of liver. Ew. Indeed is where they, I know it sounds disgusting, but they're very talented. So Help is a film from, see, 1960. What year did this movie come out?
1965.
And it is the follow-up to Hard Day's Night.
Wow.
And, well, I mean, it, there was actually, when they were planning this movie, they, there was, the initial plan was that they were going to do basically Hard Day's Night again. And as they started getting into it, it kind of evolved into, well, okay, well, what about this adventure movie where one of the guys gets a ring on his finger that he cannot get off? And that ring has mystical, was basically part of this occult ritual and sacrifice. So all of a sudden you get all of these sort of cult members chasing him. And I mean, it's wacky. It's absurdity. It's a farce starring the Beatles. But I found the story pretty charming, and I found the Beatles themselves to be exceedingly charming. And this is a movie that's just really, it's a lot of fun. It has great music from the Beatles in there. And the Blu-ray that has come out was, it was one of the best just full package releases of anything, of any genre that we've covered this year. I mean, they went all out with special features. They really did a great job restoring it, first of all. It looks tremendous, but even more so, it sounds incredible.
Well, yeah, it's what you want from a music movie like
Indeed.
This.
Indeed, but it's not always something you get. And man, they went all out with this. And they have missing scenes, they have documentaries just about the restoration. They have radio spots. And the artwork, actually, as you open the box, is just, it's like this whole beautiful little presentation, you know, even as you're just looking at the packaging. And I thought, wow, this is, for a movie that a lot of people kind of put in, you know, cast aside as like, well, Hard Day's Night is sort of the quote unquote, the Beatles movie.
I've always been more of a Help guy myself.
Yeah, no, me too.
And maybe it's because, like, before I saw any of the Beatles movies, I was watching The Monkees, which was like practically a spin-off of this movie, just with totally different people.
Yeah. No, you're not wrong. That's definitely what happened. But yeah, I think this is one of the best releases of any genre this year. And I, being a fan of this movie, was so happy to see that they really didn't hold anything back in terms of bringing this to high definition.
Even having a booklet included with original posters and lobby cards, yep, and stuff like that, remembrances by Richard Lester, the director who also helped create the Superman movie, for the record, and Martin Scorsese. Yeah, this is a classic movie that even if you're not really that big of a Beatles fan, you're probably going to find pretty funny.
Indeed. Yeah, it's pretty hilarious.
Well, for me, I also waxed nostalgic. And going back and making my
picks. Do you need me to leave before you do that?
No, that's a different kind of waxing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I went back to 1979 for Jim Henson and the Muppet Movie. Nice. Finally getting a release on Blu-ray.
True story.
I don't know why they didn't put it out when the Muppets, they should have put it out at the same time they put out the Muppets, the new Muppet Movie. It seems like that would have been sensible. But no. And this is still, to me, the greatest of all the Muppet movies. This is the one that, like, every song has got a warm place in my heart. It's a road trip movie with all the Muppets getting together, going to Hollywood because they're determined. Kermit has a dream, and they're all like, I want in on this dream. I have a similar dream. So let's go to Hollywood where we believe we can make it, filled with guest stars from the time, like cameos from like all sorts of goofy people. The best still being for me, Steve Martin as a waiter, like the worst waiter in the world is so funny, but Telly Savalas, Orson Welles, Paul Williams, Richard Pryor, Cloris Leachman, Carol Kane, Madeleine Kahn, Bob Hope, Elliot Gould, Dom DeLuise, James Coburn, Mel Brooks, Milton Berle, and his penis, and Edgar Burden. You don't get to see his penis. I'm just kidding. That'd be funny if they'd made a puppet of his penis.
That's more of a Meet the Feebles thing, I think.
Yeah, I think it probably was. But absolutely terrific and great, super memorable songs. This Blu-ray that's called the Nearly 35th Anniversary Edition. That
Close enough.
Made me laugh alone. Looks and sounds pretty damn good, is what I was hoping for. But best of all, there's some cool extra features once again. Now, I mean, you get a little silly stuff like Sing Along to Rainbow Collection and the various songs. Okay, a lot of kids' films that come out do that sort of thing, and that's great if you have kids. Or if it's a party and everybody's high on ecstasy. Well, I don't know what you're talking about. That would never happen.
No, of course
not. But there's a weird little short with Pepe the Prawn taking a very Entertainment Tonight look at Kermit's early years and career. It's got one of those cool Disney intermission things where they do songs and there's weird new animation. Best of all, there's a extended camera test, which is something I almost didn't watch. It was like 18 minutes. What's the point of this? Dude, it is Frank Oz and Jim Henson with Kermit, Miss Piggy, and Fozzie just spitballing. like for like almost 20 minutes.
That's incredible.
Because they were testing like lighting and sound and from various distances and like various areas. And they're literally just talking to each other, fucking around. It's like, oh my God, this is crazy.
That is, I want that on every Muppet film that comes out.
So yeah,
I want that on every movie in general that comes out.
Just like have scenes where the Muppets show up.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Anyway, this is great stuff. And I, like I said, I still think firmly the best of the Muppet films. Definitely something you should be checking out, and definitely a royally awesome version of it on Blu-ray.
I just am now imagining Kermit as Mr. White in Reservoir Dogs and them doing that test and just being like, I have Madonna's big dick coming out of my right ear and Toby the Jap, I don't know what, coming out of my left. It's like, yes, I want that in every movie.
Funny is, how much as every comedian has had the Muppets doing like foul mouth stuff like that, it always kind of creeps me out. I'm like, I mean, like, even Meet the Feebles, like, I was gonna, I felt like I had to run and go throw up at one point. I mean, yeah, it's a very good movie, but the conceit freaked me out.
No, I'm with you on that. Meet the Feebles freaks me out, too. Which is why it is not my next pick, but instead I'm going to go with a 1982 Sidney Lumet film that just hit Blu-ray this year, Death Trap. If you haven't seen Death Trap, oh my God, this is a classic film in every sense of the word. You have a cast that includes Michael Caine and Christopher Reeve, as sort of this, Michael Caine plays he's a playwright who is starting to lose his edge. A lot of the plays that he's been putting out lately, after being very acclaimed early in his career, his latest stuff is getting trashed by the critics, and he feels like he's at the end of his career, of his run. And then,
why do you think
that
was, Ollie? He got old!
And then all of a sudden, here comes this peppy young upstart playwright, like, oh, I'm just a college kid, and I sure would like you to read my play and tell me if it's any good. Played by Christopher Reeve, and he plays it so well. And Michael Caine reads the play, and he's like, fuck, this is great. This kid is going to completely ruin me. So he starts to plan, instead of helping the kid develop the play, killing him and taking credit for the play. So,
as you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny because all of the playwright character's plays are murder mysteries. So now he's kind of formulating his own murder mystery to take this play. So it's sort of meta in that way. And then it gets more and more and more interesting. I'm not going to spoil any of the surprises, but suffice to say, it's a wonderful film. It's so beautifully shot, but, and Reeve and Caine are at the top of their game. But what really sells this movie is the intricacy of its plot, is the twists and turns of its story. Very much like if you were watching a really well-developed play. And I love this movie so much, and I'm so happy to see that it's on Blu-ray.
It was originally a play.
Yes.
Like, it was an award-winning play, and then made into this film. Like I said, I love this movie as well. It's funny because it was not widely liked when it originally came out as a movie. It's just over the years, it's really gotten more of a cult following, because it has a sort of con film thing to it, too.
Oh, totally.
Where nothing's ever really what it seems, and everybody's plotting something other than what they are actually saying they're doing. And it's a lot of fun.
Unfortunately, there are no special features to be found here, because this is a Warner Archive title. Warner Archive did a short run of things that they were taking out of the archive and putting on Blu-ray, which is great, but unfortunately, when you deal with archives like that, you don't deal with special features.
No, not generally. Well, I'm going to pick a smaller film as well, just not an older one here for my next pick, and that is Robot and Frank.
Nice.
It came out originally in 2012, starring Frank Langella in it's one of the best roles of his career.
Agreed.
Such a fun, cute comedy where he is an older guy, ex-convict, ex-cat burglar, you know, who's got dementia. He's deteriorating and he doesn't want to admit it to anyone. He's an old curmudgeon. His son, James Marsden, is an attorney, got a family of his own, gets tired of having to show up there every week, and he doesn't want to put him into a nursing home, so he purchases a robot companion voiced by Peter Sarsgaard, which is the idea is that it's supposed to be there to provide all his care, his healthcare for him, as well as just being a friendly companion, play games, do stuff like that. At first, of course, he's an old curmudgeon. He hates this thing, but he starts actually warming up to it after a while when he changes the voice to Scarlett Johansson and they have a tour to... No, wait,
you
sorry.
Can't do that in every movie, Chris.
Sorry. It was just... It really took control there. No. He starts becoming friends with it, and when he starts teaching it his old tricks as a thief, like teaching it how to pick locks and stuff, because the thing's a learning robot is designed to evolve, and it turns into a really funny and bittersweet comedy.
Definitely.
Like, well, one of the best films of 2012, and also features Liv Tyler and Susan Sarandon. just such a wonderful little film. I can't recommend this enough. There's not enough people who made the point of seeking this one out.
Agreed.
And you really, really should. Now, unfortunately, once again, this is one of those ones where there's not really much in the way of extras. There's a little bit, not really much worth speaking of. I think there's like a little featurette making of, but either way, this isn't the kind of movie you get for those. You watch the movie and then you sit there and feel melancholy for a little while.
Well, and here's like the ultimate indicator that not enough people sought this movie out is it's not even on Blu-ray.
Yeah,
just it only DVD. Exists on DVD.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just ridiculous. This is one of those ones that really that should have gotten like Independent Spirit Award attention when it came out. It was like that yeah. quality of good.
Definitely. Well, for my next pick, I'm going to go with something kind of heartwarming, but maybe in the cockles or the subcockles of the heart, and that is The To-Do List.
Well, there were cocks mentioned, that's for
sure. There you go. The To-Do List is a recent comedy about a young girl who is about to go to college. She was an overachiever in high school and realizes that she's about to go to college with absolutely no sexual experience whatsoever, and her friends convince her that that is something she definitely does not want to have happen because everybody else will be so light years ahead of her in terms of sexual experience. So she makes a list of all of these different sexual experiences that she wants to have before going to college. And Aubrey Plaza plays the main character. And normally we've seen Aubrey Plaza sort of play a disconnected, very jaded sort of punk teen character. And in this, she's way more of a sort of a babe in the woods.
Yeah, well, she's like, the thing is, she was a nerd, but in the sense that like she was a scholastic nerd in school.
Yeah.
She was just really good at it and proud of it. And didn't really matter that much whether or not she had a big social group or any of that other stuff. So she kind of missed all of it. But when her older sister, who was very sexually active, and some of her other friends let her know, like you said, yeah, you're going to want to find out about this. She approaches it in the same way she approaches like studying for things in classes. Like, I'm going to make this list of stuff I've heard about and go out there like it's a science experiment, finding men and being not terribly selective about it.
Not really, no.
It does end up being very funny, and it's, I mean, like every other film we've ever seen like this, oh, the nerd needs to get laid before the end of high school, it was just a big, dumb, misogynist party film. Fun sometimes, but still, big, dumb, misogynist party
sure.
film. This is such a different take on the concept, turning it around. There's lots of laughs just at the expense of those other movies.
This
as well.
Actually reminded me, I think I said this when we reviewed it, but it reminded me of that character from Mallrats, who is collecting data for a book about the libido of men ages like 18 to 25.
Kind of like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's just such a strange and what, I mean, the comedy comes from sort of the absurd academic angle that she approaches this with, despite the fact that she is a complete klutz. She's very awkward, but it's so funny to watch her sort of try and fall into a sort of sex kitten role and not be terribly good at it. And then kind of come to realize that, fuck it, sex is not a big deal, I'll just approach it however I approach it.
Yeah, taking it too seriously, putting too much weight on it. This also stars Bill Hader, who's terrific in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel Bison, Christopher Mintz-Plasse, Andy Samberg, Connie Britton, the great Clark Gregg.
Indeed.
Donald Glover, a lot of people, and is a lot of fun as well. You get, of course, commentary from Bill Hader,
yay!
And the writer-director, about 4 minutes of extended scenes and deleted scenes, outtakes from the shoot, a interview with the director. You know, it's not like a huge amount of stuff, but this was one of the better comedies this year, no question. And one of the standout sort of R-rated sex comedies I've ever seen in its own way, and that it really kind of breaks new ground.
I think this and Easy A are like two films that you need to watch and go, not all sex comedies are the same.
Very, very, very true. Well, I am going all the way over to France.
What?
It's true. And gonna pick one of the films that was one of my favorites of 2012.
I was wondering why you smelled like cheese.
No, that's just because I was eating a lot of cheese.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. And it was a huge hit when it came out in 2011 in France. That film is called The Intouchables. I'm ashamed of you ugly Americans for still not knowing what this film is, because it's so fucking smart and funny.
Look, Elliot Ness is not going to bring down Al Capone on his own. You people need to go out and see this movie.
That's The Untouchables.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. Now, the lead star in this, Francois Cluzet, if you saw the thriller Tell No One, which won all kinds of awards a few years back, you might recognize him from that as well as other. I mean, he's got a huge, long career, especially in French film. But this is the first time I personally have seen him do comedy. And he here plays a guy who is I believe he's like a quadriplegic, I think. But he's, you know, stuck in a wheelchair, can't do much, very frustrated about it, very impossible to deal with. And he ends up forming a relationship with the man who's hired to be his live-in caregiver, who is one of those guys, like, he's not qualified at all for the job, even a little bit.
Right.
You know, a kind of a play-it-by-ear, fun-loving black guy played by Omar, what's his name? Omar Sy, who I believe is actually seems to be one of those up-and-coming actors in general for stuff right now.
Hmm.
Kind of an interesting guy. He's in X-Men Days of Future Past.
He's Bishop.
Bishop.
Oh.
But he has got he's just got so much life. And the other guy is so tired of everyone else, like, eggshelling around him that he's like, no, this is the guy. And everyone else around him, all the fancy rich people, because he's so super rich, like, no, this is inappropriate. He doesn't even have references. And his normal way of dealing with him is just to go, fuck you!
Yeah.
So he actually becomes friends with this guy. They really bond and start going and doing a bunch of really crazy shit together. And it's so much fun. It manages to both be life-affirming and sweet and also just, like, look around, make sure nobody else is seeing you laughing at some some of the parts of it. Really great stuff. Can't recommend it enough. You know, I mean, I know even I am standoffish about French films a lot of the time, but this is a truly great film. Only about 5 minutes of deleted scenes. That's about it for the extra features. But honestly, the movie is enough.
Right on. And that laugh at hearing that he was going to be Bishop wasn't me making fun of French people.
Mm-hmm.
That was my genuine excitement laugh. Just like, oh, I can't wait.
He was also in Mood Indigo.
Oh, yeah.
The new Michel Gondry played a Fantastic Fest this year as the best friend of the main character, Nicholas. Nice. He was fucking great in that movie. So this is one of those guys to keep your eye on.
Definitely. Well, I'm going to go from here. I'm going to talk about a movie that is also about two unlikely companions coming together, and that is The Heat, which is a film I did not think that I would like at all.
Well, put this on the record books. This went on someone's best of the year list.
I mean, in terms of comedies that were released this year, I really, really dug this, and I did not like... I mean, kind of in the way that you're a sucker for con films, I'm a sucker for buddy cop movies.
Yeah.
I love the shit out of buddy cop movies. Good, bad, indifferent, it doesn't matter. But I do think this was legitimately good, and I was surprised because I am way over Melissa McCarthy. I'm just,
She's
get it.
She's been overexposed in a bunch of really crappy movies that have her just playing a thoroughly unlikable person and expecting you to, eventually like her in them, except like Identity Thief, where she never changes. She's always a horrible person. And then the end, you're supposed to be rooting for her.
Yeah. So, fuck that.
Fuck that.
And that's the thing too, is they've done so many movies too, where it's like, hey, she's fat. Isn't that funny? And I'm like, it's kind of a giant step backwards for female leads. And yet she's being praised at the same time for like, you're breaking new ground for women in comedy. I'm like, is she? Because they're literally just making jokes about her being fat. So I'm not sure that qualifies.
Well, this does seem to be the one that kind of breaks away from that to a certain degree. Brought to you by the guy who did Bridesmaids, Paul Feig, who was a big hit for him. And certainly was her breaking out film where everyone's like, wow, who the hell is that?
Definitely. And, you know, as much as I actually didn't care for Bridesmaids, I liked this a lot. And I think this movie is... It works. I understand what Paul Feig was trying to do with Bridesmaids, which was, you know, women can do gross out comedy too. But the thing is, I get to the end of that movie and I'm like, yeah, but I don't care. Like, I don't like you, your character.
It's still another unpleasant gross out comedy.
Right. Exactly. And it's the exact same way I would feel about, you know, an all male, like, gross out comedy where I didn't care about the characters, which would just be, this is stupid. I don't give a shit. But in this movie, he's actually like, okay, now we're going to take the buddy cop formula that has traditionally been dominated by male actors and put females in it. And this works so much better in that regard because Sandra Bullock is so funny, is like the most uptight, most anal retentive OCD cop that you will ever hope that you never run into.
Man, and Sandra Bullock had a good year.
She really did. Yeah. She had this and Gravity and and then she gets paired up with Melissa McCarthy, who is a complete rogue. Like, you want to talk about, like, Riggs and Murtaugh in this situation? She's like Riggs and a half. She's like if Mel Gibson now was Riggs.
Like, if you put, like, Riggs and Murtaugh and cross them over with The Odd Couple, like, fuse them in the fly machine, you know, then you would have these characters.
Indeed. And I thought the dialogue was really funny. I thought a lot of the supporting characters would turn up, even for a scene. Like, the scene with Melissa McCarthy's family had me rolling on the floor because they were just over, they were like exaggeratedly Boston.
Well, with the wonderful Michael Rapaport.
Playing, oh, yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much all anybody ever asked him to do is, yeah, like, we need this really Boston-y guy who's kind of naive.
Yeah, exactly.
Call Michael Rapaport.
And there's a whole scene where they're trying to ask her if she's a narc, but because they're from Boston, they just keep saying knack. And yeah, she doesn't know what they're like, am I a what? A knack. Are you not a knack? And she's like, I don't know what you're saying.
I've been there.
Yeah, right. I always make the joke that, like, the hardest thing to do in the whole world right now would be to work in an Apple store in Boston.
Yeah.
Because people come, I want the new iPad.
Yeah.
The iPad? The iPad. iPod? Which one? Which one, damn it? Anyway, so I just thought this was really funny. I thought the chemistry between Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy was great. I thought they set up not only, really fun comedy sequences, but also some actually impressive action sequences for a movie that is largely a comedy. And I was like, okay, you know what? You have won me over, movie.
Fair enough.
So it ended up on my list.
And filled with bonus features, oh, which is always nice. These type of comedies almost always do have a lot of this because they're nowadays nobody's paying for celluloid. It's all digital. They're like, fuck it. Just keep filming.
Yeah.
Like, let's just try different takes of this and just make it up as we go along. And then you end up with lots of like bloopers and outtakes and alternates and gag reels and yada yada.
And I love that there's like six different blooper reels on this. They're all called different things, but they're all essentially just blooper reels. You get bloopers for days.
Yeah. Yeah, so if you really like this movie, there's no end of stuff with it, including the weirdest thing ever for something like this. They got the Mystery Science Theater guys to come in and do a commentary track for
it. That's another reason this ended up on my best of list.
Another one I'm like, why isn't that happening on every film that
comes
out?
Thank you!
Just saying. Anyway, my next and last pick for comedies for this year is The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Of course.
Just a... Oh, I hear it. Come on, go ahead and make
it. No.
Now.
This is one that was going to inevitably end up on somebody's list.
It came out in 2012. It's an adaptation of a 1999 novel that was extremely popular when it came, and it was actually directed by the author of the novel, Stephen Chbosky. How do you say CHB? That's interesting.
You're on your own, buddy.
Kabosky. Kaba.
I feel like we're both having strokes right now.
I actually am, but don't tell anyone. how do I describe this? I really identified with the world, this coming of age film, with the world they lived in. It was only a few years after, you know, they're only a few years younger, really, than I am. Like taking, like for when I'm in like my senior year of high school was like maybe 3 or 4 years after this. And the music that's in it and the things that are going on with these guys as they're just trying to get through the end of this period of their life were all too familiar. Here we've got Logan Lerman, who you might recognize from, the Percy Jackson films.
Oh, yeah. No, I haven't seen those yet.
You haven't seen those yet?
No.
Oh, well, they're not good, so that's fine.
Well, they're not good, so.
He's actually the one person who's really young in this. It's his freshman year, and he ends up becoming friends with two seniors, Emma Watson, oh yeah, and Ezra Miller.
No! Get away from that kid! Get away from him evil!
No, he's not Kevin, and we need to talk about Kevin.
Oh, thank
anymore.
God.
Whew. Now he's actually the really nice gay kid.
Okay.
and Emma Watson is his fag worm. As they were.
I love that you blurped out the word.
I know, I blurped out the wrong word.
Yeah, you edited out the wrong word.
But you guys know what I'm talking about, the old expression, that girl is best friend.
This is
really
bullshit.
Wildly gay guy who, and they do everything together. That's them. And
you're
them.
A real shit.
But they're a lot of fun. Charlie in here, Logan Lerman, is just a total nerd. And these two bring him out of his shell completely. And, like, teach him how to be a cool kid. And they do it in a really smart and funny way. I mean, this is one of those films that's, like, as much as the to-do list is straight up a comedy.
Right.
This is, like, feels more like something that really happened to somebody in real life, and they just kind of worked out with comedic aspects some of the funnier parts.
It's a little more introspective and cathartic in that way.
Yeah, it's a dramedy.
Dramedy.
But wow, I really love this, really connected with it. Paul Rudd has a good role in here as well. Dylan McDermott, Joan Cusack, a lot of familiar people to see. Tom Savini, of all people. Apparently John Hughes wanted to direct this before he died and or at least write the screenplay for it. It never ended up happening.
Which is funny because the whole time I'm watching this movie, it felt like a lost, John Hughes movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah, it really, really does. But be glad he didn't, because apparently he wanted Shia LaBeouf to play the lead.
Well, then I am glad he didn't.
Shia LaBeouf would be like, no, I wrote this whole thing. It's all me.
If the critics hate it, I'll just write about how horrible the critics are.
It's, you know, like I said, great sound with this terrific soundtrack. I love the soundtrack with this. Multiple audio commentaries, interviews with the cast and crew, about 23 minutes of deleted scenes with optional commentary by the writer-director.
Wow.
7 minutes of dailies from the film. It's a good package.
Right on. Well, for my final comedy, we've talked at length about how comedy is very subjective. In fact, probably the most subjective genre of film. So, you know, what one person finds funny, you know, versus what another person finds funny is often vastly different. But even more so than that, we can be surprised from movie to movie. Like this type of movie we don't normally like, and yet we watch another one that's almost the exact same type of thing because of one or two different elements being tweaked, suddenly it's a movie that you enjoy. And that's kind of why I put 21 and Over on my list. It's not the greatest comedy of the year by any stretch of the imagination, but whenever, you know, much like with The Heat, whenever I'm able to go into a comedy that I'm not expecting much from and have it thoroughly surprise me,
yeah,
that's when I really start to look upon it fondly. And 21 and Over looked to me like Project X. Looked like Project X meets The Hangover, and
Project X meets not really a road trip, but road trip-ish. Like, now we're going here.
Like an all-in-one night comedy, you know, something like After Hours. And that's actually a compliment that I will pay to the film, is that it's more like After Hours than it is Project X or The Hangover. Is it's just one night, you know, these guys trying to, they take out their friend Jeff Chang. Who I know his name is Jeff Chang because they say Jeff Chang like 38 times in the movie.
A few times.
We actually tried to make a drinking game out of it, but then we got too drunk to remember the rules after a while.
Yeah, I was going to say that was a terrible idea.
It was a horrible idea.
You might know him as Eric Yorkie in the Twilight Saga.
You might if you watch that Drek. but anyway, it's just, you know, it's a very simple setup. You have these two friends who, you know, take their buddy out for his 21st birthday, they get wickedly drunk, and then it's just about them trying to, it has almost like a Weekend at Bernie's element at points where they're trying to find like their passed out friend and drag him back home.
Well, yeah, because he's got his really hardcore Asian parents are showing up early in the morning to take him to like one of those, this is your whole future type deals.
Yeah.
And if he's not there, like his life is fucked, basically. Yeah.
And I found that what made this for me were the main characters played by Miles Teller and Skylar Astin.
Yeah.
I believe is his name. Skylar Astin from, Pitch Perfect. And then, of course, Miles Teller, who was in The Spectacular Now. Yeah, and
that guy's also, like, building up quickly.
Yeah, it looks like he's gonna be the new Mr. Fantastic and the new Fantastic Four.
Really?
Yeah, like.
Seems a little too young for that.
That's what a lot of people are saying, but again, it's Josh Trank, so yeah.
We're gonna assume he knows what he's doing.
I'm just gonna trust him on that. But yeah, I just thought those two guys played off of each other so well, and Jeff Chang is one of those guys that, like, even at his most drunk and obnoxious, he reminds you of your favorite drunk and obnoxious friend, and you can't help but laugh and kind of love the guy. And
it's like, one of these days, he's going to kill himself, and we'll all be very sad, but the funeral is gonna be a riot.
That's true.
Because we're all going to be laughing. You remember that one time Jeff Chang did this?
Yeah, God, Jeff Chang. Who doesn't love Jeff Chang?
Feels like that Saturday Night Live skit.
Bill Brasky. It is kind of like that. But they, you know, they set up these wacky situations that aren't so unbelievable that you're just like, okay, what fucking school is this? You know, it's just, I enjoyed it very much. I thought it was a very unassuming comedy. It knew exactly what it was. But at the same time, it wasn't so comfortable resting on those laurels that it didn't strive for quality.
Fair enough. Well, that does it for comedies.
No more laughing.
So now it's time to be serious.
Let's get serious for a moment. Let's bring it on down.
And we're going to talk about the best dramas to come out on Blu-ray and DVD this year. I'm going to jump right in with Argo, the extended edition. Yeah, I know it was one of the best Blu-rays to come out last year. It's still one of the best Blu-rays to come out this year.
It may end up on this list every single year.
Because they just keep putting it out with new features. Eventually, Ben Affleck hand delivers it to your house and dates your mom.
Wearing the Batman costume.
Exactly, the whole time. And you're like, Batman is my dad. Argo, just a terrific movie, winner of the 2012 Academy Award for Best Film, and arguably the best of Ben Affleck's three directed films. Who knew this guy's real talent was being a director? And even so, he plays one of the leads in this film and is terrific in that as well. His acting has come a long way in the last 10 years, to be sure. this the re- what sets this apart from the earlier version about guys, CIA agents trying to pretend that they're movie makers from Canada in order to sneak hostages out of, or potential hostages out of Iran in the 1970s. What separates it from the regular edition, which was already pretty good? Well, it's one of those, much like they put out with The Town, there's a lot of extra physical stuff in here. A 64-page behind-the-scenes hardcover book, a 16x20 map with scene-specific notes, a replica Tony Mendez, which is Ben Affleck's character, ID badge, a mini poster, a CIA confidential envelope. As well, this is an extended cut. It's about 10 minutes longer. It does, I mean, to be honest, it doesn't make that much difference. A little bit here, a little bit there, but whatever. You might as well have the one that Ben Affleck felt like was the one he really wanted to have out. The best thing here is a feature that's called Argo Declassified, which actually is a featurette about the real story of what really happened in real life, interviewing those people in question on here. But there's a lot more stuff beyond that, including an explanation of Argo Fuck Yourself, and then all the stuff that came out of the impressive list of stuff that came out on the previous edition of this. This is a terrific set and definitely belongs on anybody's best of the year list.
Agreed. Well, I'm going to go to another movie that was a re-release and a far better release than its original run, and that is The Fugitive, which I know what you're thinking. Like, everybody knows The Fugitive is a good movie. Sure they do, and sure it is. But the thing you have to understand is that the original Blu-ray for this film is, like, on a lot of high-def pundits' lists of the worst initial Blu-ray releases of all time. Like, that and Ghostbusters and Predator, I think, are like the three that get bandied about the most, because the original Blu-ray of this looked super duper shitty. Mm-hmm. Like, you might as well have popped in the VHS.
And,
like,
it just, yeah, and scratched it first.
It's just, it's shit. And this one came out, and actually Luke and I were so concerned as to whether or not they would have vastly improved it that we actually looked at it side by side with the old Blu-ray, and it is night and day better. And it looks better in both night and day scenes. It's incredible the improvement that they've made from the original Blu-ray release to this one. So, well, you know, good, in and of itself, I think that's why this movie belongs in one of the best drama categories.
This is one of those Harrison Ford films that belongs right up there with some of his other greatest films, like Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's a fantastic thriller chase film with Tommy Lee Jones as well. This was the really, for general audiences, the now we know who Tommy Lee Jones is film.
Yeah.
Who's so terrific in this as well. Such a great mystery. And they do, in fact, actually put stuff on here that makes it, like, with extra features, well worth your money.
The breakdown of the train wreck sequence is a lot of fun to watch.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's such a spectacular moment in the film that it's fun to see how they did that step by step.
And there's also the TV pilot, the reboot of the, cause it was originally a TV show. Then they, in 2000, they made a version of this with Tim Daly playing Kimball and Mike Letty Williamson as Lieutenant Gerard. And they've got the first episode of that on here for chits and grins, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting footnote to the kind of legacy of The Fugitive, although I don't even think the show made it a season.
Yeah, I don't think it did either. Yeah. All right, so my next pick is actually one of the best films this year.
Yeah.
That's Mud.
I think this was my number one. I think on my, like, we had to, you know, Chris and I, as virtue of being part of the Austin Film Critics Association, have to turn in not only our picks for various categories, but then they actually ask us to submit our top 10 films, and I'm pretty sure this one was at the top of my list.
Pretty sure this was on everybody's list somewhere for top 10 of the year in Austin. This is written and directed by Jeff Nichols, who previously made the film that also was on every Austin Critics Best of the Year list, Take Shelter.
Yep.
This one pulls out Matthew McConaughey, who just made the best career move ever about 2-3 years ago, into going, why I keep doing all these stupid romantic comedies and shit? Why don't I focus on really serious, like, Southern Gothic drama? Yeah. And ever since he did that, it's been like, whoa, dude.
Why don't I work with Steven Soderbergh and Jeff Nichols? And
yeah, exactly. And the story here has two teenage boys in Arkansas, Ellis and Neckbone. Only in Arkansas is there going to be a kid named Neckbone.
True
who,
story.
Basically, like, they're kids. They like to go out and, like, do stuff without their parents knowing what they're doing. So they steal a boat. And they go out to this little island in the middle of the Mississippi River where Neckbone had found a boat stuck high in a tree. And of course, I mean, I thought same thing. I was like, if I was 13, 14 years old, nothing could have stopped me from going out there and trying to fuck with that boat.
It's an awesome fucking treehouse. Yeah,
exactly. But they go there and they find out someone's living in there. A guy named Mud, Matthew McConaughey, who claims he grew up in the town, but he says, look, I gotta meet someone here on this island. You boys be doing me a huge favor if you go out and you bring me some food. Well, obviously not everything is as it appears, but everything's not necessarily as as nefarious as it appears about Mud either. He's one of the more interesting gray characters I've seen in a film anytime recently. And McConaughey, but McConaughey gives an excellent performance, and the main kid, Ellis, played by Ty Sheridan, who is going to move on to bigger and better things, to be sure, gives a tremendous performance as well. And a film that's ultimately one of the more brutally honest coming-of-age stories I've seen in some time. And sort of like, hey, a lot of the fantasies you have about being an adult, they're really, like, not, the truth is more banal.
Yeah.
You know?
Definitely.
But such a super terrific film. Some of the best performances and screenplay writing from this year. Of course, with special features, you get a director commentary. Jeff Nichols is just such a talent. It's amazing to hear anything he has to say at this point. And that featurette focused on Jeff Nichols. Like, apparently, this has been a film he's been trying to make his whole career. There's a piece about the cast. A thing about, apparently, he wanted to, his idea was to write a poem for this part of the world. Mine would be, see you later. Or whatever a haiku that has those words in it.
Sure.
And then a look at the snake pit. Which is a close-up look at one of the more memorable sequences in the film. Absolutely terrific stuff.
Yeah. I was going to try and compose a limerick about living in the South, but then I realized that never mind. It was not going to work at all. I lived here, but now I'm gone. That's how it was going to end, so enjoy that little ending that I just gave you.
It's odd that everyone in Texas seems to insist this does not count as the South.
Well, Austin doesn't count as the South.
Well, even Texas in general, they're like, this isn't the South. Like, Georgia and all these places that are like north of here are the South. Texas is Texas. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
Texas is Texas.
We have a weird sense of geography.
It's its own direction. You get here and the compass just starts spinning around.
And then turns into barbecue sauce. It's incredible.
Compass barbecue sauce.
Right. Well, for my next pick, I'm going to go with Only God Forgives, which was the latest film by Nicholas Winding Refn, and a very divisive film, to be certain. I mean, I saw this with a group of critics who, you could almost draw a line, like 50% really loving it and 50% just absolutely wanting nothing to
do
with it.
I was the line straddler, the only one I knew. I felt like I was in Tex Arkansas. I was or Tex Arkansas.
Arcana.
Arcana, is that what it is?
Tex Arcana.
Where you can stand in three states at once. I'm like, I don't know. I like this, but I didn't like this. And I thought, you know what? I'm just not going to talk to anybody.
Well, I loved this movie, and I loved it specifically as this weird sort of, you know, it's funny that special feature on Mud talking about writing a poem to the South. This felt like a weird sort of religious tone poem that was taking place in Bangkok, and follows Ryan Gosling as a former boxer and a guy whose brother gets involved with some really nasty things and then ends up getting killed. And basically, Ryan Gosling starts out this movie thinking, well, he kind of got what he deserved, and he really did.
He was a piece of shit.
He was a total piece of shit. And yet, here comes Lady Macbeth, Ryan Gosling's mom, played by Kirsten Scott Thomas, who, by the way, was number one on my list for, like, best female performance this year. It was fucking insane. Like, she is my favorite villain of 2013. Huh. She was just so icy and just so heinous, and she played it with such resolve, and I loved it so much. But really, the reason that I'm putting this on the list in terms of Blu-ray is that the cinematography in this film is just dazzling.
Oh, it's unique and beautiful. It's one of the standout. I mean, you say what you will about the plot. Mm-hmm. If that bothers you, it's meant to bother you. But like, if you don't like it, if it's too slow moving, that's your own thing. But the cinematography is, there's just moment after moment that you're like, I've really never seen anything that's like this before.
I'm not saying that it was terribly difficult to accomplish this, but they did turn Bangkok into this sort of this like nightmarish dreamscape.
Yeah, totally.
And I really loved.
Yeah, and when I was watching it, I was like, this is somewhere between an Alejandro Jodorowsky film and a David Lynch film.
Yeah.
In a weird sort of way. I mean, I keep thinking they're going to say this is all in the Black Lodge in Twin Peaks.
Yeah, which is funny because I kept thinking like there were certain points where I was like, this feels like a neon version of the Overlook Hotel.
Yeah.
Because they were just like, you'd be wandering down corridors and not really knowing if you were going to hit, you know, a door that was an exit or you were just going to fall into a bottomless pit.
And sure enough, this was actually dedicated to Alejandro Jodorowsky, which I was like, okay. I guess if anybody was going to be a big fan, it was going to be Nicholas Winding Refn. So.
Yeah. And I thought it was a really unique story. I really loved the performances and I absolutely adored the soundtrack and the cinematography. So I think just by virtue of those things alone, this is something that you really need to have in your collection, especially if you want to show people the capacity of your high definition TV.
Yeah, it's a odd looking film, but beautiful, certainly looking. And it's got commentary with Nicholas Winding Refn. It's got director interview segments. It's got a lot of behind the scenes segments. It's got a special about the music with Cliff Martinez, which had really good music. So there you go. And then apparently there's like a leaflet with information on obtaining 2 free MP3s from the soundtrack. I'm like, really? Why don't you just put them on there? I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
It seems like you just put them on the disc, put it in your computer, eh, click and drag. There you go.
I don't understand technology.
Anyway, my next pick is one of those films that was on some critics' best of 2012 list. It seemed also to be somewhat divisive of whether people really liked it, really hated it, or just were kind of, I forgot I saw that. And I fell on the I loved it side for The Impossible, a Spanish disaster drama film that was based on the experience of Maria Belon and her family in the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami that, of course, we all know about now, because the news networks love their disasters, don't they?
They sure do.
But this starred Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor as a couple who's there at this Thai hotel with their kids when this tsunami comes in like a tsunami.
Like a tsunami. I was like, yeah, that's the apt metaphor here.
You go, I don't know. I mean, we see stuff. We've seen earthquake movies. We've seen, like, tornado movies. What is it like to be there on the seashore when a tsunami comes in? It's pretty much like you're by the swimming pool, and then there's 10 feet of water above that a couple seconds later.
Yeah, it is not. It's funny. Like, they do a great job with the special effects in this movie to recreate it, but at the same time, it's not about the spectacle, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like in the movie Twister where, like, the tornado roars and seems to have an agenda.
Well, like, the first 20 minutes of this is just, you know, setup and then the disaster and watching it happen. And it's terrifying and the effects are fantastic. And you're, like, edge of your seat rooting for these people to find a way to survive this experience. Or specifically Naomi Watts, who the film is following and doesn't know if her kids are alive, doesn't know if her husband is alive. And the rest of the film is her, you know, after it's, you know, the water has receded and everything is destroyed, her wandering around, severely injured, trying to reconnect with her family and find her way through this mess to see if they're to live with hope and hope that they're all still alive. And it is. It's really inspiring. It's really powerful. You know, a lot of people were critical of it, saying like, oh, they had a white girl play a Spanish girl. I'm like going, we all need to calm down a bit about this type of thing. If it was the other way around, nobody would have said,
how dare you tell me to calm down, white man? You don't own me.
I just like, I think we're getting a little overexcited here. And the point is, Maria Belon was also a rich person who was vacationing at a Thai thing. I don't think really the color of her skin played that much into it. They weren't from Thailand.
It's not about the color of your skin, but the color of your money.
Well, people assume they hear the story and they think to themselves, oh, how you tell like a story of an English person instead of a Thai person? She wasn't a Thai person either.
So it's really you who's racist for assuming that she was Thai and poor just because she wasn't white.
I don't know who's racist. We're all racist.
We're all fucking racist.
Everyone's racist. Yeah, this is actually a great movie. Really enjoyed a beautifully shot film. And one of those ones I will go back to and watch again for the really incredible Naomi Watts performance. I still think she's one of the most beautiful actresses in Hollywood. In fact, I was watching one of her movies when you showed up.
Well, I mean, it's great that we have Nicole Kidman 2.0. I think that's wonderful. Oh,
don't be like that.
She looks like Nicole Kidman. I don't know what you want me to say.
I don't see it.
She reminds me a lot of Nicole.
But there's audio commentary, a featurette on casting it, a look at the special effects, which quite a few they did practically, deleted scenes, and the trailer. This is a good package.
Right on. Well, my next pick is going to be a very, you know, I'm picking challenging movies now with Only God Forgives, and my next one, which is Upstream Color.
You get out of my house.
I liked this movie a lot, but it's a difficult movie to recommend to the casual viewer.
Or anyone, if you ask me, but
I really enjoyed the hell out of this movie, but it is one that it's a weird sort of urban sci-fi romance. I don't like, wow. It is a really hard movie to pin down, but I it's a journey that it takes you on, and I really enjoyed. It's from Shane Carruth, who also did Primer, and that was kind of the big draw of the movie, is that we hadn't seen a Shane Carruth movie since Primer.
It's been a while.
And it had been, you know, a decade ago. And we were all just waiting to see what he was going to do next. And with this film, he really does kind of, like, the very, like, nature of being, and the very nature of where our personality comes from, and who we are, and how and why we connect with other people. But it's done in such a way that, like, the whole time you're watching it, for a while, you're just not sure whether the images that you're seeing are in any way connected, which sounds, and you know what? In any other film, I would say that that would be a problem, but the way that this all kind of comes back around just had me scratching my head and going, huh, I really am fascinated by the ideas being presented here. But again, totally understand that this is not going to be everybody's cup of tea, but I do think it's one of those films that in terms of drama and in terms of the things that were, dramatic films that were released on Blu-ray this year, it's definitely something you want to pick up because it too has, it has more enigmatic cinematography. It's not quite as vibrant and alive as something like Only God Forgives, but you're still going to watch this and be blown away by the imagery. And I think that's something that really deserves to be seen in a high def format.
Sadly, despite the fact that the packaging was very attractive for this and neatly put together, there's literally not a single special feature on this.
Which is such a shame because I want to know more about this movie. I want to hear Shane Carruth talk about where this idea came from. And frankly, whether or not my theories about the movie are correct or if I am just way off base. Because it is one of those movies that's just like, well, audience, what do you think?
Well, I guess my problem with it was I don't mind abstract films, but it was abstract to the point where, like, I literally had no clue what had happened in the film at all and wasn't particularly titillated because it was moving at a Terrence Malick pace for me. Mm. It was like, it seems appropriate that he only makes a movie once every 10 years, which is sort of that Malick path as well.
He started shooting this the day after Primer, and it just took him this long to finish it.
Exactly. you know, a lot of people love this film. I just was one of those people who came out, same way I did after Tree of Life, like, just pissed. Mm. Like, God damn it.
I hate beautiful things.
Why can't we have
smashing
beautiful things?
Jokes.
Because I destroy them.
Give me more Underworld films.
I would watch Underworld 4 any day of the week again before watching this.
I can't argue with that because I kind of would too. I like Underworld 4 a lot. Damn it!
I win.
Just when I thought I was artistic. Oh, well.
My last dramatic pick is Silver Linings Playbook. Woo. David O. Russell's film from last year, which, of course, this year he's got American Hustle on the way. But Silver Linings Playbook ended up being one of my favorite films by this guy. And it's certainly one of his most emotionally complicated films. And I think the reason of that is because this relationship between two severely bipolar people, mm-hmm. played by Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, and, you know, multiple nominated, Oscar-nominated roles, are spectacular. They're so strong. For both of them, they're the strongest performances of their career. And the story isn't really – it plays with aspects of the traditional romantic comedy. Like, at one point, they decide they're going to enter a dance competition, stuff like that. But that stuff is really – there are these little moments of warmth interrupting what seems to be a completely impossible relationship to ever work. I mean, it's hard enough to date someone who's bipolar if you're not, much less to have two bipolar people connect together somehow. I can tell you that from personal experience in the distant past, 3 or 4 times. What am I going to say? Red hair. You know, it's a thing. You're like, man, don't go out with the girl. She's crazy. Yeah, but it was a problem I used to have.
What I really like about this movie, though, is it's not a traditional construct in the sense that you don't have these characters who think that the whole point of being in love is to fix the other person.
Yeah,
this is more a movie about how crazy sometimes needs crazy, and I really dug that about, like, these people are not only allowed to remain who they are, but they have to be in order to be with one another. Like they, it doesn't work if they're trying to be something they're not.
In some ways, they're crazy almost cancels each other out.
Yeah.
Because, like, when they're together, they can talk about all this crazy stuff, but they kind of keep an eye on each other in their own sort of way. Like, they're a support system for each other. And even the movie is, like, not romantic enough to say, this is gonna last. It really ultimately is a sort of like, well, who knows if this is going to last or not, but it's at least nice that these two miserable people have found a moment of quietude and peace in their life. Yeah. And maybe it will work.
I just like the fact that, you know, they're so chaotic individually, but yet they're still each other's constants.
Yeah.
I love that message about this movie. And Jennifer Lawrence is, wow. Like, I just was blown away entirely by her performances. Because, I mean, the only thing we'd seen her in really up to this point were things like, you know, the X-Men First Class and the Hunger Games. And it's not like she was bad in those movies.
Well, and Winter's Bone.
Okay, well, that's a good point.
Also spectacular.
That's a good point, yeah.
But this is even more so than Winter's Bone. I think she really pulls it out in this. And wait till you guys see American Hustle. I mean, say what you will about the rest of that movie, she is phenomenal in it. And, like, you think she's crazy in this? But either way, this one's also got Rob De Niro, Jackie Weaver, Chris Tucker. You're like, the official Where the Fuck Has That Guy Been award.
Yeah, they make him wear a red and white striped sweater and a little hat and cane because it's like, where the fuck have you been?
Julia Stiles, Shea Whigham. Great cast, great movie, one of David O. Russell's best, and that's saying something. The Blu-ray comes with about 26 minutes of deleted scenes, which apparently are much better than you usually would see from this sort of thing. A featurette that just interviews with cast and crew, Q&A highlights, rehearsals of the dance, the big dance scene in this. A thing about the choreographer, Mandy Moore, apparently. did the choreography of this film. She has a how-to lesson on dancing. And then there is a little segment where Bradley Cooper's pretending to be a cameraman for some reason.
There's like everything you need to know about the movie is summed up at the end of that dance scene where they are so excited to get a five.
Yeah.
They are so elated to be average. Like that's like this like strange goal. It's like we broke even. We're doing well.
It's weird how I think a lot of people just don't get why aspects like that film, like that in the film, or what make it so great.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, there's this beauty in just getting something finished.
Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, yeah. I mean, like, it's the same reason some people go to marathons and don't care about their time. They just want to finish it.
Now, I know that your next selection was going to be Side Effects, but you remember we already did that on
Did I? I couldn't remember if we did or not.
We did, in fact, already cover that.
All right. Well, then let's move on to the next category.
The next category is... Drum roll, please. That's a fast drum roll. Jesus
Thank you.
Christ. What are you, Gene Krupa over here? All the kids are like, who the fuck is Gene Krupa?
Neil Peart, motherfucker.
Don't worry about it. The horror, science fiction, or just plain weird. You know this is the category you've been waiting for.
This is a giant safety net of different categories.
If there ever was one. Yeah. My first one is one of the greatest horror movies ever made that finally has gotten a decent Blu-ray release, and that is Universal's for their 100th anniversary, they were putting out some really nice editions of a bunch of movies, and this one is Jaws. Still one of the scariest movies ever made about the giant... Do I really have to tell you what the fuck Jaws is about? Seriously.
No, I mean, you don't.
You know what? I'm just going to tell you the whole story. Anyway, so... Here's a story of a giant great white shark
now, this
that's probably
is a story.
Crazy by its size and its age.
This is a story all about how a shark bit me and chewed me right down.
I like that version better. This was the breakout film for Steven Spielberg, no question. It's the movie that made everyone go, who the fuck is this guy? And was a movie that they were absolutely 100% sure was going to fail.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like so sure this was going to fail.
Well, I mean, just if you look at the problems in production alone, it's like, oh my God, what the fuck did we just fund?
And really the best thing about the set, which is, this had previously come out just right beforehand in 2012, but this is a much nicer hardbacked edition with a few extra things, is it comes with one of the greatest documentaries made of any film ever, originally made in 2007. The Shark is still working the impact and legacy of Jaws, which is full-length movie about the making of it, how it influenced people, and how literally... I mean, there's interviews with Spielberg where he's going, like, this is going to be it. This movie is going to be totally fucked. No one's going to see it because it's a piece of shit. The Shark won't work, and I'm never going to work in Hollywood again. I might as well go look, figure out what I'm going to do next. And then, of course, it ended up being one of the biggest blockbusters of all time when it came out.
And it's funny. I think the documentary is actually longer than the runtime of Jaws.
Yeah, well, there's two documentaries on this. There's that, and there's The Making of Jaws, which is another one that takes a look at all the little pieces. I mean, this is just as solid as a extra features for a classic movie can get, quite frankly. And this is a classic movie. If you've always avoided Jaws because you're like, I've seen enough killer shark movies, they have never made a shark movie as good as Jaws.
There is no way on earth you have seen enough killer shark movies if you have not seen Jaws. And if you've been watching killer shark movies and haven't seen Jaws, I don't know what is wrong with you.
You have failed.
I don't understand. Like, I want to understand you, but you're making it very difficult.
Numb nuts.
I'm gonna go in terms of horror. I'm gonna go with Resolution, which was an independent film that didn't get a lot of notice. But man, you want to talk about a really creative concept and execution that far outweighs the limitations of the actual production. This is an incredible film to watch. It's about a guy who goes to save his friend who is a meth addict. And the way he does that is he goes to the house where his friend is squatting and handcuffs him to a pipe and is just like, all right, detox, just let it work through your system. And you think, okay, well, obviously it's going to be a Saw thing. It's not at all. What happens is the guy starts to find various materials, you know, of steadily increasing complexity. So at first it's like photographs, and then it's like an audio recording, and then it's like a reel of film, and then, you know, it just keeps going and going and going, all suggesting that there is something really strange and really supernatural going on with this house, with this area. And it's just sort of how that mystery unravels is the crux of the movie. And man, I was loving every step of that journey. I was like, I want to know more. Like, tell me more.
And it's an odd journey in the way it sort of dovetails in on itself in a way that you don't expect and brings you to that sort of like creepy, mysterious ending that, you know, for my money is doing something like the Blair Witch Project tried to do and failed, except here it actually works.
Mm-hmm. And do not be fooled. If you buy this Blu-ray, there is a terrible pull quote on the cover that says it gives Cabin in the Woods a run for its money, or puts Cabin in the Woods to shame.
It's like nothing in here that's even mildly like Cabin in the Woods.
Nothing to do with Cabin in the Woods whatsoever. And just, sometimes people just say things to say things. And sometimes those things get put on the box because the companies that release the film, the distributors go, oh, that's a movie people know. Anyway, don't be fooled by that. This is a film that is wholly original and something that I it made me really excited to see what Justin Benson and Scott Moorhead do next. And actually, David Lawson as well. I want to see what those guys do next. I am really excited. Like, these are guys who kind of understand both how to make a lot out of a little and how to be unique and interesting while doing it.
Yeah. So. Absolutely. Really clever little film. One of those ones came out of nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
And another one that came out of nowhere, maybe not nowhere if you know who your classic directors are, is John Dies at the End. This is directed by the great Don Coscarelli, probably best known for the Phantasm films, and what's the one with Bruce Campbell?
Oh, Bubba Hotep.
Bubba Hotep. Yeah, yes, thank you. Sorry, I don't know how that got out of my head. This came out in 2012. It's now out on Blu-ray and on Netflix, based on David Wong's novel at the same time, which was already a cult hit beforehand. This stars Paul Giamatti, Clancy Brown, Angus Scrimm, Daniel Roebuck, and Doug Jones. But none of these guys are the lead characters.
Yeah, if that's confusing to you, just wait.
Instead, you've got, essentially, if you ever watch the show Supernatural, it's the Winchester brothers. If there was some sort of monster that caused, like, incredibly huge hallucinations and affected changing all of reality, like, if it was them versus Cthulhu, and they made it a comedy, what it would be like. Chase Williamson and Rob Mays play the two friends who, as we see in the beginning, are basically like supernatural exterminators as they're dealing with a giant zombie made out of literally pieces of like household, like frozen meat.
Yeah, it's an amazing sequence. I love it so much.
So much fun. But it flips to one of the guys being interviewed by Paul Giamatti, who's basically somehow found out about this guy and his claims and says, look, just tell me your story, whatever. And he's like, you're not going to believe me, but here it is. And so this is flashing back and forth with him telling him the story and these bits of the story of this whole adventure that he had where he's very early on, his best friend, John, dies, and one of the two brothers, and is able to talk to him through anything. Hot dogs, trees, dogs, afterwards, because time and dimension is like almost meaningless in this situation that they found themselves in. It's not absurd to confuse you, and in its own sort of way, it's not even confusing. Yeah. It sets its rules up that are going to make everything be discordant and like, you know, out of place, but it makes sense within that rule base, and it continues to be funny as hell. Lots of unexpected shit goes on here. Great monster design. So funny. Just a terrific cult horror comedy novel. I just love the shit out of this thing. I can't believe I haven't read the book yet, which I really do need to, but if there was ever a movie where you went, oh, I hope they make a sequel, this is one of those films. It is so much fun. And it comes with commentary by the director, the producer, and the two leads. 9 deleted scenes. Just a 7-minute featurette on the making of it, a look at the special effects, props, and creature design, casting sessions, a Fangoria interview with Paul Giamatti, who I bet never thought he'd be on a Fangoria show. No. And then just a little promo trailer for apparently the sequel novel that David Wong actually wrote called This Book is Full of Spiders.
I love that title. I know. So much.
It's so great.
This book is full of spiders. Well, I gotta go, like, I loved, John Dies at the End because it was, it's one of those directors who, you know, you and I know a lot about, people like us know a lot about, but the general public is still like, who is that?
No clue.
You know who else is like that?
Who else is like that?
William Lustig.
What a shocker.
William Lustig is one of my favorite, genre filmmakers, cult filmmakers. The guy just, he loves what he does, and he does it so well. And he is responsible not only for the 1980 film Maniac, but for the entirety of the Maniac Cop franchise.
Pretty
no
much
relation.
Any film with the word maniac in it, William Lustig did it.
And I was so happy when, you know, this is, gosh, now I'm completely spacing. Was
what,
this
year it came out?
No. The company that released this Blu-ray was Synapse, right?
Sorry, I scrolled down to the wrong place to check such things. It's Blue Underground.
Oh, this is Blue Underground.
Which is why I didn't
okay.
get it.
Okay, well, this is, that's good, actually, because Blue Underground is a company that is run by, or was originally founded by, William Lustig. And the reason he founded it is because he got tired of not being able to find good transfers of some of the Italian horror movies he loved so much. So he just went out and bought the rights and did it himself.
Why not?
And so it's just so, it's so awesome that finally we have a Maniac Cop 2, Blu-ray by virtue of his company, Blue Underground. Now, I know what you're thinking. Like, a horror sequel to a film that even by itself a lot of people haven't heard of? Why? Well, I'll tell you why. Maniac Cop 2 is one of the best action horror films you will ever see in your life.
And strong words, my friend.
I'm telling you, not only is it a lot of fun in terms of being a horror film and bringing back a character that is really kind of bizarre and weird in the best way, but the stunt sequences in this film are downright irresponsible. That's how good they are. Like, there's a scene where a guy is lit on fire, walks around on fire, and then falls out of a three-story window onto a truck while on fire. No, not a dummy, an actual stuntman.
Jesus.
And then there's a sequence where a guy is thrown out of a window, bounces off a van, lands on the ground, stands up, and then Robert Davi shoots him.
Was Jackie Chan the stunt coordinator on this?
You would think, man. It is, like, the whole movie, you're just blown away by these sequences. There's a sequence, a raid on a police station that is just as good as the one in Terminator.
What's funny is that if they were doing this to horses, we'd all be up in arms.
It's true.
We're like, nah, it's just people.
Yeah, fuck people. I'm okay with it. People know what they're getting into.
I like this has got Claudia Christian from Babylon 5.
It does. And that's kind of...
Campbell, Robert Davi, Robert Zadar, of course, returns as the man with a face like a baseball glove.
It really does look like a catcher's mitt.
I'm sorry. Crazy. It's just like, it's ridiculous how much it looks like a catcher's mitt. And an early Danny Trejo appearance in this as well.
Definitely. And that's the thing is the first one had such a great ensemble cast of 80s mainstays. You had Bruce Campbell, you had Tom Atkins, you had Robert Zadar. You know, a lot of these people are returning here as well. But, in this movie just kind of, It develops the character, I guess, the monster a little bit more, but really what it's interested in is being, one, a hard-boiled detective movie starring Robert Davi as sort of a Mickey Spillane type, and then it also is just a balls-out action film, and just, like I said, it's so good it's irresponsible. And it looks tremendous on this Blu-ray. Like, I mean, I guess I wasn't expecting William Lustig's company to skimp on the transfer of his own movie, but it is Maniac Cop 2, and again, most people are like, I didn't even know there was a first one. But it looks, it is so stellar what they've done with this release. In fact, I think it got, on most sites, got a perfect rating for video quality.
Wow.
Which doesn't happen very often, and it sounds great as well. And it comes with some pretty great special features. You know, the trailers, they are what they are, but I really like Back on the Beat, which is a documentary that Blue Underground put together all about the making of Maniac Cop 2, and they bring back everybody, including Robert Zadar, who unfortunately does not look good.
Well, he never did.
Well, but, like, he looks like somebody who is allergic to shellfish, who ate a lot of shellfish.
Oh, boy, that's... He always looked like that.
No, trust me. Like, you see this, and you're like, somebody needs to pop him. Yeah, so it's got a great new commentary by William Lustig, and really that the in terms of special features, the reason to own this is Back on the Beat. That's such a great documentary about
47 minutes. That's
and it's very candid. Like the actress, like the main actress in the movie talks about how much she hated working on production, and William Lustig's like, oh yeah, I guess that's why I haven't seen her in 20 years. It's like, he's so, like, they're just so open about it, and they kind of recognize that it has a cult following, and yet I still maintain, like, this is, like, if you're talking about, if you want a horror movie that also has a lot of action in it, this is one of the best you can find, and I love this movie unabashedly.
Oddly, the commentary for it is not just Bill Lustig, but Nicholas Winding Refn.
Yes.
For just, like, I love this film, I don't know what to tell
well,
you.
Well, there's a reason for that. Nicholas Winding Refn is writing the remake of Maniac Cop, so.
So this will later become more valuable by that being a thing.
Just because.
Just because. Well, you know what? I'm going to steal one that was probably on your list because I'm just an asshole. And that is Halloween, the 35th anniversary edition. You knew this was going to end up on this show. You knew it was. You're like, man, those fucking guys in their horror movies, you shut up. Because Halloween...
Even if you were just stabbing in the dark as to what we might put on this list, you might have picked Halloween.
Halloween. Yeah, I know what you did there. I'm going to let it go. Halloween, of course, is the classic slasher movie. It's the progenitor of almost all American-made slasher films. It is still one of the best ones ever made with that introduced the world more or less to Jamie Lee Curtis as the Scream Queen and later a quite gifted comedic actress in movies like Trading Places, and as well as a lot of people who didn't know from like Westerns and war movies as well yet, Donald Pleasance, mm-hmm. who is wonderful here as a completely over-the-top doctor who's the only one who knows that Michael Myers, the psycho, has escaped from the insane asylum, isn't just insane.
He's gone from here! The evil is gone from here!
He's evil! Just wonderful. John Carpenter does to some of his best cinematography ever in here, and certainly some of the scariest moments he's ever filmed.
All praise is due to Dean Cundey, who is Carpenter's longtime DOP.
Yeah, and this is the one that's overseen by him, am I not mistaken?
Yes, this is a really interesting release. Now, I know what you're thinking. Halloween's been on Blu-ray several times. Why are you featuring this one on your list? This actually goes back and removes a lot of the artificial autumnal tones that were added after the fact. Because you realize they shot this movie in spring in California, not in the fall in Illinois. So they had to make the movie, give it more of a fall appearance. So that was kind of added artificially. So what they've done with this is they've gone back and removed a lot of that to kind of show. And again, they're going to be people like, well, why would you want to see that? And that's a valid question. I want to see it because I just love this movie and I'm kind of an academic about this particular film. I just love it so much and I want to know all of its many facets. I want to see this movie from every conceivable angle and see what it has to offer in its various versions. And I think if you're like me, if you love Halloween to that extent, this is something that you're going to want to get because it really is an entirely new way of looking at the film that we haven't seen before, and it's entirely worthwhile to have that experience.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And once again, it's Halloween on Blu-ray, plain and simple. You got to have one version. Why not get the one that's in a hardback book with a bunch of like a booklet that comes with it that's built into it?
Mm-hmm.
Why not? Definitely. It's got like an hour-long piece with Jamie Lee Curtis discussing the monetization of Halloween for charity.
It's a weird thing where she goes to a convention to sell autographs, but she's doing it for a charity, so I kind of forgive her, but she's kind of whacked a little bit, too, and I kind of like that about her. Like she's not all there.
It's got an on-location look 25 years later where they go back to the neighborhood and the shooting locales. That's becoming more and more common on these things these days, especially for some reason with horror movies in particular.
Yeah. There's like a guy who was doing an internet series of these for a while that has found its way onto various, especially Shout Factory releases, found its way onto various horror films because he just happened to cover all these movies in that series.
Right. And then there's the TV version footage because, like, this is another weird thing that happens a lot. The television cuts will have extra footage that never showed up in the regular film versions, and this is just that stuff.
There's some creepy shit in that TV version. There's a scene where he goes to an elementary school that Michael has apparently broken into, and there's like a butcher knife stabbed into the desk and the word Samhain written on the chalkboard. It's like, whoa, what?
Well, you can probably see why they cut that out even so, because it's like a little too definitive that he really is from the devil at that
point. Yeah, you're right. And in fact, that more supports where they went with like Halloween 5, you know what I mean? Like it's almost like an unintentional setup for a sequel, you know, 20 years later.
Right. Whereas one of the things that makes this interesting is you don't know completely whether he really is just a crazy guy or Donald Pleasance is also a crazy guy as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's Halloween and you should get it.
Yeah. Why haven't you already bought this version?
I don't know what's wrong with you, quite frankly.
Well, for my next pick, this is interesting. I'm not really sure where to go from here, but if we're going to go, we talked about horror a little bit. Mentioned sci-fi a bit in the previous one, so I'm going to go with the just plain weird category, Manborg. Wow. What the fuck?
Yeah, this is more on that John dies at the end category.
Yeah.
Like, this is just weird. I don't know what to tell you. It really doesn't fit. I guess it's sci-fi?
It's
technically?
Yeah, I guess it is sci-fi. It is made as cheaply as humanly possible.
It looks like one of the old Sega Saturn CD games.
Yes,
where
exactly.
They would like the extra CD player so that they could throw video into it and have video manipulated with like video game backgrounds.
And it looked terrible.
But it looks like that.
They've recreated that.
They have.
There's like, There's also a lot of, like, claymation effects and stuff that looks like it's from trauma movies and...
Just every, like, cheap way of doing stuff, like, with these type of films crammed together in one movie that, like, and covered with, like, neon tinsel. Yeah. you know? And early 80s video game level graphics. And somehow all these things crammed together in the same package make for a really fascinating looking film.
It's the Ratatouille of B-movies. Like, it's just you... And I don't mean to say it mimics the plot of the movie Ratatouille. I mean that it feels like a dish that was compiled of the leavings of other dishes.
Pixar's Manborg.
Yeah, and yet somehow I think it's the sincerity of the people involved to just kind of do something and have fun with it and really kind of love this strange era of film, which I don't particularly love. I hate trauma. I hate that fucking studio with everything in me. And yet the people who are kind of coming out of the fandom, like... The young filmmakers coming out of, you know, being raised on trauma are doing some really cool things, like Jason Eisner's doing a lot of cool stuff. And these guys, with Manborg, certainly made something that is, you're not going to forget that you saw it. I can give you that much. It's, you know, you have characters like Lord Draculon and...
Man, you got to love Lord Draculon and his Nazi vampire forces.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what else? If you played the game Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon.
Yeah.
And you want to see a movie that kind of looks like that. This movie kind of looks like what a Far Cry 3 movie would look like.
If they were to make a Far Cry Blood Dragon movie, they should get these guys.
Definitely.
Totally. So bizarre. Like, weirdly mixed with, like a Manborg, so there's elements of RoboCop in here. I don't even know how to describe it. This is just...
Lots of, like, Italian post-apocalyptic crap.
This is like people like you and me, if we were like 18, had incredibly rich parents who gave us as much money as we wanted and an endless supply of pot.
Yeah. Well, okay. And then we spent the money on more pot and then made the movie for $12.
Yeah, exactly.
This is, it's a very bizarre film. I can't guarantee that you'll like it. I can't.
I can't either. But on the other hand, this might be one of your favorite films that came out this year too.
Yeah.
It's one of those movies you don't want to watch by yourself anyway. You want to watch with a group of people. The drunker, the better. I mean, even just putting it on the middle of a party.
Yeah.
Like just as the party's getting started, there's like maybe 8 people there so far. Breaking the ice, like, hey, let's watch a little bit of Manborg. The ice will be broken, my friend.
Definitely.
As you all sit there going, what the fuck is this?
It will be broken into shards that will then be stabbed into your eyeballs.
Well, as long as we're talking about what the fuck movies, let me go with a science fiction what the fuck movie that was an old, or I'm sorry, horror what the fuck movie that was in it. One of my old favorites from 1987 because of how... I mean, it's crazy, yo.
It is crazy, yo.
What a bizarre, like some of the strangest horror effects you've ever seen. And yeah, it's repulsive. This movie, Street Trash, it's as repulsive as the name is. It's just the ugliest parts of humanity. It's like John Waters wanted to make a psychedelic horror film, like with the nasty, nasty shit that goes on in here with this. The main plot is really, nothing to do with the title and the stuff you see in the trailer, which is about this case of cheap wine that gets found that's over 60 years old and has gone bad and causes people to melt away in bright colors, Technicolor, for some unexplained reason, but it looks awesome.
Like an Uzi Play-Doh pinata.
But the main story is about two brothers who are trying to deal with being homeless while there's this psycho cop at a cop who's trying to get to the bottom of all these other homeless deaths that's trying to end this deranged Vietnam veteran homeless guy who's been killing people and being an asshole and a drug dealer. I don't know. I mean, it's trying vaguely to make a point about homelessness, but who cares? You're just waiting for somebody else to melt down and explode, which looks amazing in this. It's hard to call it fun.
Yeah.
Fun is not the right word.
It's an oddity. It's a real oddity. Something that you should kind of just see to believe.
Yeah. There's nothing like it. A lot of the effects in here are beautiful, once again, the wrong word, but so intricate and so well done, and there's nothing else like them.
Grotesquely captivating.
Yeah, and it's got, as one of its lead characters, the guy who was from Frankenhooker.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it's got, the thing about this edition that makes it so special and on this list for me is, man, they did not fuck around with the extra features on this thing.
Way more special features than this movie probably deserves, but damn, they went all out.
Two commentaries, 123-minute behind-the-scenes history of the making of this thing, involving everyone, including Bryan Singer, who was his first job on this picture as a production assistant, and most of the cast. 15 minutes of the original 60mm short film that got the money to make the movie, also called Street Trash. 7 minutes of deleted scenes and outtakes, an interview with an actress from here, Jane Arakawa, promotional teasers, trailers. This is actually, I mean, you can't believe they spent all this money on putting together extras for this, but hey, it's one of those weird cult horror films that, as you said, has to be seen to believe, to be believed, and you very well might just fall in love with the thing.
Well done, Synapse, putting out Street Trash on Blu-ray with such care and craft, and probably more so than was put into the movie itself.
Yeah, probably so.
For my next pick, I'm actually going to go with another sequel, and that is VHS 2. VHS was, of course, it was sort of the double whammy of horror subgenres, because it's an anthology horror, and each of the vignettes is a found footage movie. So you have kind of both of those things going on at once. And I really liked it. I thought it was one of those movies that, it's not really that the sum is greater, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. It's more of a certain vignettes carry the movie. Like, they're, yeah. Like the strength of the movie comes from two or three outstanding vignettes.
For me, there was one that was outstanding, two that were pretty good, and the rest was kind of crappy.
That's fair. But I really liked it, and I liked the experience. But when I heard they were making a second one, I was like, oh, well, I don't know if they'll be able to maintain that. But then I started hearing about the talent they lined up. You know, they bring Simon Barrett and Adam Wingard back, the Your Next guys. It's like, okay. Eduardo Sanchez, who did Blair Witch Project. It's like, okay, now you've really got my attention. You have the guy who's kind of responsible for found footage in being used in the horror genre and becoming a thing before it was kind of brought back by Paranormal Activity. And then you also have Gareth Evans, who did the fucking Raid. And I'm like, okay, now I'm really on board. And then they threw in Jason Isner, and I'm like, shut up and take my money. I want to see this fucking movie.
And the thing about this is I think it blows away the original.
It does.
In every way, shape, and form. Every single one of these is worth watching. And one of them is so good that I would demand that you go see this as soon as possible, just based on the strength of the Gareth Evans one alone.
Yeah.
You know, just so good.
Yeah. All of these vignettes are really strong. The wraparound story is a little bit weaker than it was in the first one, but not by much. And in fact, you're not going to want to spend a lot of time with the people in the wraparound, because you're going to be like, I want to see the next story. Show me the next story.
Yeah, put the goddamn videotape in already.
But yeah, I definitely agree with you 100%. Gareth Evans is by far the best vignette, in this collection. And I dug the shit out of VHS 2. And I agree with you also that it is better than the first one.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. Gareth Evans also did a terrific martial arts film called Marin Tao that you should seek out if you get a chance to.
And he's currently hard at work on The Raid too. Oh
yes,
my God.
He is. Well, it's not even hard at work. It's done.
Oh my God.
Damn.
I'm so happy. I'm so excited to see that.
This Blu-ray comes with a commentary on every single one by the filmmakers in question doing each one. It's got a short segment with the producer and a writer co-producer. Look at it. You know, it's got various different featurettes on every single thing in here, basically. Every single piece, as well as separate promos for the films, behind-the-scenes photo galleries, trailers, yada yada.
Yeah, good stuff. Absolutely
great
stuff.
It is fulfilled.
It is fulfilled. What's your next pick?
My next pick is my last pick from this our favorite category. Next to Criterion's, that is, which, you know, that's part one. You have to go back and listen to that. And I had to put this on our list for our good old friend C. Robert Cargill, also known by some as Carlisle.
Just so that we wouldn't get bitched at for the next year.
And it really is a great movie.
It's
his movie Sinister, the first screenplay that he got bought. And it, luckily enough for him and everyone, it was a monster hit, so to speak. Get it? Because there's a monster in it.
I get it.
Get it? But this story gets Ethan Hawke in their lead as a writer who's trying to, with his family, moves into an old murder house without letting them know that it was, ends up discovering a box full of Super 8 films up in the attic, starts playing them, and realizes that, like, everything, reality is not what it seems. There appears to be a mysterious figure in each one of these things, and this figure starts introducing itself into his own life. Genuinely scary, very fun as well. Sinister is kind of changing what people want to see in horror right now. Between Sinister and Insidious, I felt like this was really this big movement back towards creepy ghost movies, and it's continuing now with movies like The Conjuring, Insidious 2, and more on the way. I had a great time with this. Cargill did indeed write a great script, and if you want to hear more, everyone's like, put Cargill on more podcasts. Well, there's an audio commentary on here with Cargill and the Scott co-writer Derrickson. Scott Derrickson, who was the director as well. There's a commentary with Jess Derrickson. There's a great feature here where it just takes a look at true crime authors, where it's interviewing them and talking about, like, you know, the job of it and how difficult it is sometimes to do that kind of writing, which is actually pretty fascinating, as well as a feature about looking at houses that have had horrific crimes occur in them and how realtors end up marketing those properties, which is actually a question I've asked myself too. Is that, does that make it easier or harder in today's weird fetishistic world to sell a house where, like, you know, a whole family got murdered in?
It's a good question. Yeah, I gotta get, you know, again, like, I give the guy shit. A lot of our relationship is poking fun at each other, but I gotta give credit where credit is due, and Cargill wrote a really great movie here, and I enjoyed the experience of watching it. And I will tell you this, from the very first shot of the movie, I was highly disturbed. And that is quite a compliment that I can pay a horror film these days.
It's a great opening. Yeah. You know, for the record, and this is public, he's been posting it publicly, he just finished writing the script for Sinister 2. So.
Yeah. So we'll have to see what happens with that. But yeah, it's a good one to put on the list for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, if you haven't seen it, really is. I mean, come on. Probably most of the people out there have seen it by now for no other reason than the fact that Cargill wrote it, and you're fans of his, but really, really worth your time.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, my last pick in this category is Solomon Kane, which is weird because I saw this movie in 2008.
I know. So long ago, I really don't remember it anymore.
Yeah. And it just hit Blu-ray this year for some God knows why.
Well, yeah, Blu-ray or any release at all.
Yeah. I mean, we actually had a Blu-ray from, like, Australia. It was the only place that put it out. But essentially, this is an adaptation of the comic book by Robert E. Howard, who also, of course, did Conan, about a sort of puritanical demon ass-kicker in Solomon Kane, this character who spent much of his life being a crusader, not because he was somebody who believed in the cause, but somebody who really enjoyed murder and sort of saw the Crusades as a way to exercise his fetish for blood. And he comes into a situation where his soul is being sought by the devil, and he is trying to live a more penitent life to avoid, you know, this fate, and he is dragged back into the world of violence when this family that he comes to know and love is besieged and the daughter's kidnapped, and all of a sudden it's like, man, I gotta go back to my violent ways to save this girl, and that puts my own soul at risk. But so of course you get the conflict there. And I thought this was just, I mean, again, this is a movie that didn't have as big a budget as would probably be warranted by adapting this type of material, but they did so much with it, and they made such a film that honestly I think stands up with some of the Marvel movies, like in terms of a superhero film, in terms of, you know, what we want from those movies, in terms of production, in terms of the characters, and just like the costuming and the pacing. I was like, the whole time I was having a blast, and I thought James Purefoy did a great job bringing Solomon Kane to life, and I was blown away by the whole experience of the movie. And I'm kind of sad that it took so long to finally hit Blu-ray, but I am glad that it's here now.
I wish I could say more about it. It was just so long ago, and it was towards the end of a Fantastic Fest. Was already a little burnout. We got to interview Corey, and I actually interviewed the director, and I remember he was a super nice
Michael
guy.
Michael J. Bassett, yeah.
Yeah, super nice guy. But what a great cast. Max von Sydow, Rachel Hurd-Wood, Mackenzie Crook, one of Pete Postlewaite's last roles,
I think. That's how long ago we saw this movie.
He was still alive. Jason Fleming. I mean, there's actually one of those things where a lot of people from here ended up, like, their careers
took off.
Yeah, took off a lot more after that. I remember it being fun. That's about as much as I could say at this point.
It is that.
This has a commentary by director and James Purefoy. It's got a small making up featurette, one deleted scene, a look at the special effects.
Which is actually really cool. It's a short featurette, but it's really cool.
Well, specifically about the creation of the fire demon in it, which was pretty cool. An interview with writer-director Michael J. Bassett, an interview with James Purefoy. It's, you know, in terms of just extras alone, it's a bit of double dipping, it seems like. But you know what? We don't all want to sit and listen to the audio commentary, so
no.
Sometimes you want to watch the pertinent information in a separate featurette.
True story, and it looks great. It sounds great. It's something that you should pick up. Like, even if you're not familiar with this character, which I was not when I saw it, I just thought it was great.
Well, our last category today on this episode, the next to last episode of All I Want for Geekmas,
penultimate.
Martial arts Asian films.
Hooray.
And you know what? I'm going to start this one out with the most obvious answer. A lot of people are going to think we never did. We never even included that Bruce Lee box set on our lists because, quite frankly, it wasn't that great of a set. No. They're horrible transfers. But the most famous of them all, and still arguably the best, is Enter the Dragon.
I fucking love this movie.
Absolutely
so
amazing
much.
1973 Hong Kong martial arts film that brought Bruce Lee, that made everybody love Bruce Lee. It is like, you know, regardless of whether or not you think it's the best one, it's the most famous and successful one, and had several members of the Seven Little Fortunes, like Jackie Chan and Sammo Hung. Just a movie that influenced so many other things, and this Blu-ray set they put out of it was just, this is the way you want it. Remastered and gorgeous, filled with lots of extra features, including oddly physical extra features that came with it. There was a little like a patch and stuff like that. It was just like, okay, that's pretty funny. A replica of the deputized Ali card distributed at Enter the Dragon's premiere.
Nice.
Like I said, an iron-on patch, a motion lenticular card, a booklet, that is about the photographer for the film, David Friedman, called Enter the Dragon, A Photographer's Journey. It's just really cool set. Like I said, tons of bonus features, including brand new HD stuff that's put on here with reflections on both Wing Chun, which was his martial arts style, reflection on vintage interviews with Bruce Lee, and reflections on, you know, talking about those interviews, a tour of the actual island, Hans Island, where they filmed it at, commentaries, 87-minute documentary that's a look at Bruce Lee's death, narrated by George Takei. Come on, that's awesome.
Yeah, hell yeah. It's worth it just for that.
And more. I mean, this is just like a sampling. Like, there's this more besides that is there on that as much as that makes up entire bonus features on other things. This was great.
Yeah. And it's such a, if you haven't seen Enter the Dragon, fix that immediately. It's a phenomenal movie.
Yeah, it really is. It's like, don't be like one of those, martial art films are cheesy. Yeah, sometimes, but they're also completely awesome, and this is one of the awesomest.
People
who
say this movie isn't that good, you know what I say to them? Bullshit, Mr. Handman! God, I love this movie. Anyway.
Take him to Detroit! Sorry, that's Kentucky Fried Movie.
Well, for my first pick, I'm going to go with Woochie the Demon Slayer, which was a movie we covered way back on our other show. But it was a movie we saw at Fantastic Fest, I believe. It's a Korean film about a sorcerer who kind of ends up being supplanted in modern time, and you know, it's just kind of a wacky adventure film in a lot of ways, but it's
adventure / superhero / period piece / it jumps around through time and space. And
it's a real Asian buffet. is what it is, and it's
really
just
is.
So much fun. And I had a blast watching this movie, and the effects in it are pretty cool, and they've really come up with a character who you love despite the fact that he's kind of a dickbag. He's kind of a mischievous little twerp.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I had a blast with this movie, and I think it's one of those ones that is not strictly a martial arts film, but it's just one about like magic and fantasy, and I don't know. It's something that you don't see every day, at least from, we don't see this exact type of movie from Asia all the time, because usually in an Asian film that has magic and sorcery, it's a period piece, and this is starts off as a period piece, and then the comedy of it is that everything kind of gets transported into contemporary time period.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's the majority of the film is in the contemporary time period, even, but it's one of those. There's a lot of these Asian films and mixed martial arts and wire work with CG that are absurd to the point of being like, I have no fucking idea what happened in this film. And most of them, I don't know if it's just lost in translation, are not as funny for the American audience watching it. This one actually is, and manages to get across, despite how absurd it is, how much fun everybody's having, how the CG is actually clever and imaginative. I had a really good time with this as well. There's even a bunch of, like, a lot of these don't come with these Asian movies that come over here don't have a lot of bonus features, of the newer stuff. This actually does. It's got a EPK with a look at sort of called the newest Korean style hero movie.
is that like the greatest American hero?
I guess
the newest
so.
Korean hero?
13 minutes of deleted scenes, a 25 minute making of, interview galleries, production featurettes. I mean, actually a lot of stuff, a bunch of stuff on the CG. It's a pretty solid package all in all for a film that in a community that's clogged with films that look like this, it's one of the very best ones out there. It's like, it's hard to pick out what's worth watching and what's not in this sort of genre of things, but this one totally is.
Definitely.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to go to a really goofy one as well that I also saw in Fantastic Fest, which is Dead Sushi. Boy, this is silly, and it's the type of thing that I don't normally like, those sort of Japanese Grand Guignol, everything bloody and stupid, just like for laughs. But for whatever reason, This one had me laughing all the way through it. And this is from a guy who makes a lot of those type of movies I'm not big fans of in general. I mean, like, the first, you see one or two, you're like, okay, this is cute. But as they keep going, you're like, okay, we get it. The guy who did The Machine Girl on Robo Geisha and Mutant Girls Squad.
Yeah, Sushi Typhoon stuff.
Yeah, it gets really stupid a lot of the time. But this one, where it's kind of going more in a playful sort of way, than a, let's see how many boobs we can trick you into covering with blood sort of way. The idea here is that a bunch of sushi in this restaurant, gets, like, basically it becomes undead somehow. So the sushi itself is alive.
Well, it doesn't matter. It just happens.
And sentient and seeking to bite people and can fly and has some degree of magic powers.
Okay.
It's just so bizarre, but it's genuinely funny all the way. I mean, just the concept is like, I mean, the guys who make Sci-Fi Channel movies wish they had thought of something this stupid, you know? They're like, damn.
They wish they had the wherewithal to be this idiotic.
Why didn't we think of that? Like, so this is not high art by any stretch of the imagination. This is just as lowbrow as it gets. But for me, it really worked. I had a great time with this. It's even got good gore in it at points when it is gory. And the puppets, the actual sushi puppets they've made for this are hysterical.
See, you know what? I will have to give this a shot at some point. It's just me getting over the fact that Noburo Iguchi is one of my least favorite directors of all time.
But I thought you did like one thing from him here, that Karate Robo Zabagar.
I didn't see that one.
Did you not? You actually probably like that one.
Oh, Karate Robo Zabagar. Yeah, I did. I kind of like that one.
See?
I will give you that. But Zombie Ass? Are you kidding me with that shit?
Yeah.
Literally? Are you kidding me with that shit?
And he did the F is for Fart segment in the ABCs of Death.
And that was also terrible. Most
of that film was terrible from what I heard.
Well, I think more didn't work than did, unfortunately. But when you have 26 films in an anthology.
That might be cutting it a little, you know, short there.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the movie I'm going to talk about is The Thieves, which is a film that I know we went on and on and on about on our other show. It's a film about a group of, as you would expect, thieves. It is a grand scale heist movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I was not prepared. It's a South Korean film. I was not prepared for the scope of this film. I was like, wow, they are pulling off these stunts, like, on the sides of buildings and, you know, pulling off these heists that involve, like, several people pulling several cons at once. It's like an Ocean's 11 movie.
Yeah, it was a very complex plot with big budget, great looking set pieces, lots of funny camaraderie, lots of really good martial arts type stunt action in it. Just a super fun, you're right, Ocean's 11 type film just viewed through the mindset of the South Koreans.
Yeah, and it's one that I highly recommend if you like heist movies in general. And, you know, there's a lot of strong performances in the movie too, which is not so, like, again, like if we're using Ocean's 11 as sort of the exemplar, then yeah, you expect great performances. But in a lot of heist movies where you just bring a lot of people together because you need a lot of people on the team, you're going to get a mixed bag of performances. But I thought this was solid all the way through.
Yeah, I agree with you. And there's also even lots of tributes to old classic Hollywood con films as well, which is something you wouldn't have expected in this.
Right.
Lots of good, like, sort of screwball comedy moments that, unlike a lot of Asian screwball comedy, which is awful, actually kind of works here. I had a lot of fun with this, and it comes with a 6-minute making of featurette, about 4.5-minute featurette that kind of separates all the characters because there's a fuck ton of characters in this movie. Like, you may even want to watch that first.
It's almost as if this special feature exists, though, because it's like, look, we know you're racist and you can't tell the characters apart.
No,
we're going to help you out with
that. I don't
care
what it is. You make a film this complex, this many characters, this much of a, like, back and forth plot. I do need a little bit of
No, you're right. Help. It's to me, it's not a cultural
Plus,
difference.
Plus, they're Asian.
Well, I was going to say, for me, it's not even a culture. Like, I have trouble keeping up with all the fucking characters on Game of Thrones. I'm like, which one is that? Who's that guy again?
No, God, I watch Game of Thrones with Wikipedia in front of me all the time. Seriously.
I believe you.
Got the page open. I'm like, wait, let me check that name. Oh, yeah, okay. That guy did
we
that.
Need, you know what? We should put out trading cards for Game of Thrones watchers.
Right? And just, like, flip through them real quick. Oh, let me see. It. Turn right. around the back. Oh, yeah.
He's a Lannister.
And the best
Fuck
thing is, like,
guy.
Every year you could resell them. Because, like, you're like, hey, you already have that card? Well, too bad, because new shit happens, so now you got to get the new card.
You have to shuffle up and deal players or deal characters out of the deck.
God, this is like a $1 million idea.
I'm just saying.
I'm going to edit edit this out.
Yeah, don't let anybody hear this. I don't want them to steal our idea.
All right. Well, I'm going to move on to my last pick of the show, which is for Donnie Yen. Big shocker, because he's Donnie Yen and he's amazing. In the film Dragon, which came out in 2011. An absolutely incredible. I mean, this is right up there with Ip Man for me, for one of his recent performances. Absolutely incredible martial arts film with a very complex storyline. Where he plays, he's Lu Jinxi. I guess that's probably not how you say it, but
unless he's a cat in a Hanna-Barbera cartoon, I don't think that's
correct.
He's
just a small village. He's a small farmer in a small village, and one day two bandits show up, enter the village, try to rob the general store. He's in the shop, and he fights with the robbers sort of incompetently when they turn violent, but he accidentally kills them during the fight. But during the autopsy, a detective named Zhu starts investigating. It starts realizing that everything's not how it looked. And as the film goes along, you start seeing him figuring out what actually happened in that fight scene. Even though we watched the fight scene as it happened and it looked like he was just incompetent, when you start getting into close-ups, you realize he was just using the tippy part of his tippy little toe to kick a board into someone's throat and stuff like that. You're like, starts figuring out this guy's not who he seems to be. Of course he's not. He's this uber badass that used to be a complete villain, but decided he didn't want to be that guy anymore. But the problem is, once the word gets out, there's gonna be trouble.
This movie, the movie this is gonna remind you of the most is A History of Violence, because it has the kind of the same setup where it's like, you know, two robbers come in, this very unassuming guy who everyone in the town loves ends up fighting them off, and everyone thinks, oh, he's a hero, that's where we should leave it. And there's one person who's like, there's more to this. And then as you start digging into the past, you realize, oh, this person used to be on the other side of the law. And so it has a very similar setup, but I love the martial arts in this film. I love the fight sequences.
So good.
Donnie Yen is great, as is Jimmy Wang Yu, who you might know, well, I don't know if you will or not, but you might know from the
Jimmy Wang Yu, and I don't care.
There's a great Brian Trenchard Smith movie called The Man from Hong Kong, and I believe it was the mid-70s, late-70s. Really, really fantastic martial arts film. Jimmy Wang Yu should have been a huge star, but unfortunately he was such a pain in the ass to work with in his youth that he's just like, nope, he never got the same opportunities as, you know, some of the other stars to make it big in America because nobody fucking wanted to work with him. But it was cool to like see him in this movie, and, you know, as an older Jimmy Wang Yu in a role I was not expecting. And, it was just fantastic movie all the way around.
Yeah, I can't recommend this highly enough in terms of if you're just looking for this year's The Raid, like that film with martial arts are going to make your jaw hit the ground, and watch one of the most talented performers today in film. You're going to want to pick this one up. You will not be disappointed. It was nominated for pretty much every award there was at the 31st Hong Kong Film Awards, although sadly it only won Best Original Score and Best Cinematography, but still absolutely amazing. As well, this Blu-ray comes with a 22-minute, 8-part documentary on the making of Dragon. It's got a 3-part series of featurettes that interview Donnie Yen, which, as well, you should, because, once again, he's just absolutely incredible. And, of course, these things a lot of the time have music videos, because a lot of the film industry is very closely tied to the pop music industry in Hong Kong. So you're almost always going to get that mixture of stuff.
Not that you don't find that here from time to time, but...
Yeah, but it's like... Like, actors you would never think have a musical career in Hong Kong. If they're in a Hong Kong movie, they pretty much have a musical career.
Right on.
Yeah.
Well, buy this immediately. Stop dragging your feet. And we're going to move on to my last pick of the show, which is The Man with the Iron Fists. This is a movie that a lot of people aren't going to like. But I loved this
shit. I know
shit.
A lot of people who, and you do too, who hate this film.
I love this fucking movie. This is, okay, so if you're not familiar with the RZA, the guy is a very talented hip hop.
You mean the RZA?
No, the RZA. He's a very talented hip hop artist who was part of a group called the Wu-Tang Clan. And if you're a fan of martial arts films, you might draw a connection and think, oh yeah, these guys are huge martial arts fans. And they were. That's absolutely correct. And RZA's actually worked on a couple of different films in various capacities, usually in the soundtrack area. So he would, like he did the music for Kill Bill, you know, and then he did, he would appear in some of these films. He did the music for Jim Jarmusch's Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai.
So right.
He's kind of been connected in that sort of way, but this movie was his directorial debut of him, and he's making, gosh, I don't even know how to, like a sort of a fable, like a Chinese fable story about, a man who's from America, but lives in China in the 1800s, living in one of these sort of remote villages as a blacksmith. And it's about this sort of war that's going on between all of these clans. And there's There's villains and there's assassins and everyone's trying to get this gold, and he's trying to stay out of it, but he's kind of forced into it through, just twists of fate that he can't really control. And it just becomes this really ballistically off the wall type of, martial arts film with a lot of like people spinning and flying everywhere. And, it's got a great soundtrack, obviously, because the RZA's involved. And there's a lot of people you recognize. And one of my favorite parts of the entire movie is Russell Crowe as this character named Jack Knife, who I have never seen Russell Crowe have this much fun playing a character.
He's clearly having fun.
And that makes the movie, like, honestly, like, kind of, there's a couple other characters that are having just as much fun. And I think that's what you can't help but get wrapped up in the energy of this movie and how sincerely, the RZA loves martial arts films. It's like, no, he's not the best director. No, it's not the most competent film at times, but.
No, he's not the best actor.
No, he's not. Absolutely, he is not. But I gotta tell you, like, when somebody does a project that is this entertaining and with this much, I mean, it's kind of like we were talking about with Manborg. It's like, Manborg's not a good movie.
Right.
But, like, just how much passion those people have for what they're nodding toward.
That it's hard not to have fun watching.
Yeah, and the amount of sincere, reverence that they have for what they're nodding towards is like, yes, like, I am all about this. Let's sit back and watch and have fun with this. And I think some of the fight sequences in this are actually really damn cool. So, I don't know. I love this movie a lot. I bought the soundtrack. I think it's fucking great.
I drank the Kool-Aid. Actually,
man.
I would have liked it much better if it wasn't for the RZA playing the lead role, who I thought stands out so much in his poor acting that it was hard to get. I mean, like, he's taking it so serious the whole time, and everybody else is clearly having fun that it was like...
Which is funny, because he's directing them,
like,
to have fun.
You're like, dude, you're the most boring guy in this entire movie, and you're the star of it. So, I don't know. I mean,
He's a little dull.
You're right, the martial arts film scenes are great. The actual conceit of, like, the whole weird magical world that happens in all these period piece type, like, martial arts films is cool and fun. There's a lot of great cameos. Pam Grier has a cameo in this. Lots of cool people in it. Russell Crowe's having a good time. So I had more fun with it and I didn't. And it comes with a theatrical and an unrated cut, which is 107 minutes as opposed to the 95 minute theatrical cut. 24 minutes of deleted scenes, and then just a few little, very small featurettes.
Yes. Good times.
But that is it for the penultimate edition of All I Want for Geekmas.
Geekmas is coming. The goose is getting fat. And your film critics are getting fat. Yeah, that's going to do it for us. But again, please consider using our Amazon links to buy whatever you may want in the next few days. I know people are going to be cramming in those last minute purchases. And if you have Amazon Prime, they will still get here by Christmas. So yeah, just whatever you purchase, please use our links. Please consider becoming a subscriber to oneofus.net. Holiday season, we've actually been doubling down on content. So we haven't been sleeping much. So it would be nice if you would become a subscriber and help us maybe hire somebody to take some of this shit off of our hands. Oh my God. Anywho, thank you so much for joining us. All I Want for Geekmas. We'll be back with one final round of gifts in various categories. But until then, just remember that to have a white Christmas, you don't necessarily have to eat all the powdered donuts in the box.